Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. Several sexual abuse scandals have shaken the U.S. military recently. News of a sergeant videotaping naked female cadets in a bathroom, male officers overseeing sexual assault prevention programs being charged with sexual crimes themselves. And these are just the cases we've heard about. The Pentagon released a report on sexual assault in the military, which found that an estimated 26,000 service members were assaulted last year. Legislative efforts are underway to change the way the military deals with both victims and perpetrators in these incidents. And today, we'll get an update on the latest developments with Anu Bhagwati. She's Executive Director of Service Women's Action Network. She's also a veteran and served as a Marine captain. Anu, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
In a little while, we'll hear from Jessica Henvis. She is a U.S. Air Force veteran and was sexually assaulted by a fellow service member and is now an advocacy board member for Protect Our Defenders. And Anu, I want to get started. We are hearing a lot about this issue right now, and this problem has been called the enemy within, a silent epidemic. Why is this so prevalent right now on our minds and in the news?
Well, it's nothing new. This has been happening for decades, and not only since women have joined the military. I mean, it's really a problem that faced men primarily before women started joining in larger numbers. And I do think that thanks to women serving in very high percentages in Iraq and Afghanistan and sacrificing really limb and life overseas for our country, there's finally been attention on the idea that women are serving and a real sense of gratitude for the women in uniform. And all of that, these last 11 to 12 years of war at this point, have led to media attention, which is it's unprecedented. Congress has heard of these scandals for decades now. They've held dozens of hearings, so it's nothing new for them. What's new for us in the American public is that Congress is finally paying serious attention and not just hearing from victims, which they've done time and time again, but also acting in, we hope, appropriate ways this year to change policy within DOD, because the Department of Defense has proven incapable of handling this problem on its own.
Do you have a sense whether the issue is indeed getting worse? We've seen an increase in the estimated cases, or has this issue always been this bad? I'm wondering if there has been a toll from the 10 years of warfare.
I think this problem has always been bad. I think it's actually a little dangerous to suggest that the problem is increasing. Really, you know, the series of scandals that the news has hit on in these last few weeks, these scandals are nothing new. I mean, I witnessed them myself when I was an officer in the Marine Corps on a daily and weekly basis. They are nothing new in any branch of the military. What's new is that there are local reporters at every base. There are investigative reporters from national news outlets who are going to visit the academies, who are visiting every single base in every single branch of service to make sure that these stories are brought to the public. That is what is new. I remember when I got out, I was desperately seeking media attention in 2004 for the harassment and assault cases that I witnessed, and nobody was interested in reporting these stories. So that's what's changed.
Do you have a sense whether more victims are coming forward, are bringing this, feel comfortable to report these cases?
Absolutely. I mean, there is a surge of attention and a sense of validation and support on the outside for women and men who are serving in uniform, who have been extremely intimidated and discouraged from seeking the support that they need, from reporting, from holding their perpetrators accountable. The vast majority of these 26,000 cases of sexual assault, which include everything from indecent touching to actual full penetration, the vast majority of these cases were never officially reported. And we know about these 26,000 cases because the Department of Defense conducts an anonymous survey every 2 years. And through that anonymity, people are feeling safe enough to say, yes, I was abused, I was assaulted. But they're also not feeling safe enough to officially report and to charge their perpetrator. And that tells you a lot about the climate of fear and the climate of intimidation. And that's exactly what they said when they were asked, why aren't you reporting? And because it's because they don't feel safe yet. And they shouldn't feel safe yet. It's a very insulated system. It's not like reporting in the civilian world where it's not your boss you're reporting to. It's actually law enforcement. It's actually an independent prosecutor. In the military, it's your own chain of command who is involved in determining whether or not your case goes forward. And in that sense, it's not a fair system for the accused or the victim, because it's somebody you work for or his boss who's making these decisions. It's not an independent, trained professional.
And I want to get to that chain of command in a little bit. But before we get to that, talk a bit about your own career in the military. You got into the Marines. What made you want to do that? And when did you join?
I wanted to join the most extreme force that I could. The Marines were definitely that.
Yeah.
The most challenging environment, I think, within the military for women. And very few women are in the Marine Corps. Only 6%, 6 to 7% of the Marine Corps is female. And so that, unfortunately, leads to a climate of extreme hostility toward women. You have not only legalized sex discrimination throughout the armed services, there are still a variety of jobs which women cannot legally try out for, even if they're qualified to do them. And we're seeing actually this month that the Secretary of Defense will hopefully be reporting back to the Armed Services Committees about what the service chiefs have recommended in the way of more complete integration of women and throughout the forces. But that legalized sex discrimination, particularly in the Marine Corps and the Army, leads to a lot of harassment and a culture which condones mistreatment of women overall and certainly condones sexual assault.
Was that on your radar when you joined? Were you thinking about this is going? I'm sure you were thinking about that. It was going to be tough. But were those issues on your radar?
No, not specifically. I mean, I think as a young woman growing up in New York, I was pretty street smart in the sense of being acclimated to sexual harassment, to street harassment, these kinds of things. But I didn't really consciously think about how the Marine Corps might add to that. But certainly it was a daily experience for me as one of very few women officers in the Marines, just the discrimination, the harassment, the harassing language, the exposure to rape jokes, the exposure to really harsh pornography. And also, I spent a lot of time in East Asia where it is practically a rite of passage for Marines and sailors and soldiers out there to engage in sex trafficking and commercial sexual exploitation of women and girls overseas. And unfortunately, that's happening here, too. We shouldn't forget that that's happening outside of every base locally as well in the United States.
How did you cope? What did you do? How did you respond?
Well, part of my survival tactic, it was just to cope. It was just to do the best I could, because when I raised these issues to my own senior officers, they basically laughed in my face, or it backfired. In other words, I was punished for kind of making a stink about my senior officers telling rape jokes or fellow lieutenants engaging in inappropriate behavior and barging into our dorm rooms and trying to sneak into bed with my female roommates. I mean, that kind of thing it became just kind of a day in the life, and you learn to live with it, because to speak out often leads to punishment. And at the end of the day, I mean, really at the end of my 5-year experience, I went through something really horrific in reporting harassment and assault and was eventually punished. I essentially lost my career for doing that when I was a company commander. So it's harsh. It's a very harsh environment. And, for me as an officer to negotiate that, and I couldn't do it because I was not supported. Imagine what it's like to be a junior enlisted service member, male or female, who has no rank, no freedom of movement, and to try to report in that kind of hostile climate.
We're talking with Anu Bhagwati. She's executive director and co-founder of Service Women's Action Network, and she's also a veteran Marine and was a captain and company commander in the U.S. Marines from 1999 to 2004. So you said you lost your career. What can you describe what happened?
Well, I filed a equal opportunity investigation against an offending officer who was at that point considered sort of a war hero. He had just come back from Iraq with a bunch of medals, and he was, you know, classic perpetrator. He began to sexually harass everybody in our unit, and so when it was reported to me by some of the best Marines in, you know, that I'd ever worked with, I reported
female
it further. Female Marines, and I mean, everybody was that he had a lot of victims. Let's just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the ensuing investigation was treated without much bite. And so he was promoted during the investigation. He was given command of a company and not punished at all. So I mean, he's actually still in the Marine Corps.
So that's a
typical experience.
Yeah. Describe that chain of command. Again, because that is still the same, correct? You, when anything happens in the military, you have to go to your commander to report.
Well, when I went to my commander, he swept it under the rug, and so what I did was basically commit career suicide.
Yeah.
I went outside the chain of command, which I knew would end my career, you know, in effect. And so that outside investigation. Again, it was a sexual harassment investigation in this particular case, was not treated the way one would hope because the guy was promoted during the investigation. I mean, how serious of an investigation can that be? But also the recommendations which came down, you know, there were about 60 witnesses to this guy's behavior. The recommendations actually sided with me and all of those witnesses in saying that, yes, this lieutenant is absolutely culpable of sexual harassment. But at the end of the day, it's the local commander's decision about whether or not he wants to listen to those recommendations or enforce any type of sexual harassment or assault policy, for that matter.
And
he decided to ignore all of those recommendations. This colonel decided to ignore all of those recommendations.
And
I had actually seen
true.
Far worse. Yeah, I'd seen far worse in my career. I mean, I saw in that same unit at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, I saw a sexual offender, someone who had assaulted dozens of Marines, who was a senior enlisted Marine himself. He, instead of being charged and court-martialed and sent to jail, instead of any of that happening, because it was reported by dozens of his victims, instead of any of that happening, he was literally transferred out of the unit within hours. Overnight, he just disappeared. We had no idea what had happened to him. And so I often wonder what happened to all of those young women. What happened to them? Because that was the signal they were sent, that this doesn't matter.
And the perpetrators stay in the military, best case scenario, or sent elsewhere and can find new victims there.
Absolutely.
All right. We're talking with Anu Bhagwati. We have to take a short break, Anu. But when we get back, I want to talk more about the legislative efforts that are underway to change that very system that you just brought up. Anu is Executive Director of Service Women's Action Network and is also a veteran Marine. Coming up, we'll also hear from Jessica Henvis and about her experience in the Air Force. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. If you've served in the forces or want to discuss this issue, give us a call. We'll be right back here on Radio Times.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer. Based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Christopher Guest parodies very specific subcultures, often musical ones. Folkies in A Mighty Wind, desperate musical theater types in Waiting for Guffman. And the songs in those movies sound totally authentic.
To write original music that could be considered possible, that's what we were aiming to do.
Christopher Guest talks about his career and his new HBO show on The Next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Some people say the 20s and 30s are the prime of your life, especially in Hollywood, but not Rita Wilson.
Being over 50 is completely liberating. I want to say to everybody out there who's listening who's not, Get ready. It's a blast.
She tells us more about her new project, HuffPost 50. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about sexual assault in the armed forces. It's an issue that's been documented for decades, and efforts to curb the problem have been very slow to take foot. We're talking with Anu Bhagwati. She's a veteran Marine captain, and she's also executive director and co-founder of Service Women's Action Network. In a moment, we'll hear from another veteran, Jessica Henvis, but before we bring in Jessica, Anu, I want to touch back to what we were just talking about before our break, which are there are legislative efforts underway to change the system you described, where you basically, if you are in the armed forces and you are assaulted, you have to report that issue to your boss. And it's a very kind of inside investigation, if at all. So what are some of the efforts underway to change that system?
Right. And I should clarify, I mean, ultimately, it's the report that's handled by your boss. So, you know, you're not necessarily reporting directly to him, but he is the ultimate arbiter of justice at the end of the day. And so I like to point that out, because right now we're deep in negotiation and conversation with Pentagon officials about this point. It's a sticking point, and I like to make sure that we talk about sort of the real kind of injustice, which is at the end of the day, it's not a trained prosecutor or judge making legal decisions. It's a commanding officer who has never gone to law school who is making legal decisions within the military about his troops' lives, and that has got to stop. Right now, we're working with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, both the House and Senate. We have been for years, but there's a real tipping point this year with some key leaders in the Senate taking on this issue. And one of those is Senator Gillibrand from New York, who introduced the Military Justice Improvement Act, which we helped draft. It would basically put trained prosecutors in charge of what's called convening authority. They would be the ultimate arbiters in determining which of these serious crimes go forward to court-martial, who the jury and the judge will be in those court-martials, and determining any kind of back-end legal issues as well. I mean, right now, a commanding officer has authority over a case, both before the case goes to trial in terms of selecting the jury pool and the judge, and also at the back end, he can actually legally overturn a criminal conviction as well. And it's important to realize this is not only for sex crimes. This needs to happen for all serious crimes. Right now, the Uniform Code of Military Justice is a set of legal doctrine that's over 200 years old. It determines everything legal that occurs within the military, and commander authority over criminal cases is one of these kind of holdovers from a really obsolete bygone era. And this bill, the Military Justice Improvement Act, would fix that problem, but it is facing enormous resistance from within the military and also on Capitol Hill. So we've got a long way to go in terms of making sure that people just understand we don't have a professional system within the military. It's less professional than anything else. Wouldn't you want the most qualified people making legal decisions? Wouldn't you want the most impartial people making decisions, especially when it's our sons and daughters' lives at stake? They're the ones volunteering to serve. They're the ones fighting our wars for us. And yet they have fewer rights than those who they are protecting and defending on the outside.
I want to bring in a quick, because we mentioned Washington, I want to bring in a quick clip from a commencement address at West Point in last month. And here is Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel speaking about this very issue.
Sexual harassment and sexual assault in the military are a profound betrayal. A profound betrayal of sacred oaths and sacred trust. This scourge must be stamped out. We are all accountable and responsible for ensuring that this happens. We cannot fail the Army or America. We cannot fail each other. And we cannot fail the men and women that we lead.
So Anu, he very much echoes the sentiment you just brought into the conversation. Is he in support of the legislation? What are some of the obstacles and you know, what are the what are people saying who are not supporting the legislation that's being debated?
Well, it's easy to be outraged by sexual assault within the armed forces. That's a really easy thing to do. I mean, it's widespread. And the scandals, you know, they're not stopping. What's harder is to acknowledge that this has been happening for so long and that the military has proven itself incapable of fixing it on its own and that it needs not only outside oversight but outside intervention. So, yes, there is stiff resistance to these reform efforts. In fact, I'm testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee on Tuesday. The full committee will be there. We believe it's a hearing designed to basically end our reform efforts, to basically put a stop to them, which is very discouraging. It's essentially a hearing to allow the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the TJAGs, the Judge Advocate Generals who oversee law within each branch of service, for them to say, hey, guys, we've got this, senators. We've got this, Mr. President. We can handle it.
But what's their fear? What are they afraid of if, you know, the system is reformed or changed?
Well, they're afraid of change. They're just afraid of that, right? They're afraid that commanders will lose all authority within their own units.
So it's the outside coming in?
Absurd thing. It's not just the outside coming in. I mean, the outside's definitely been coming in. It's been you know, the spotlight is on the military like it has never been before. The issue is commanders, you know, as officers, we are trained and indoctrinated with this idea that we're responsible for everything that goes on within our units. Well, there's a good side to that, but there's a bad side to that as well. If there are criminal acts occurring within your unit, but you are not qualified professionally as a jurist to deal with them, then why should you be the one meddling in sex crimes? It's a completely unjust, backwards, illogical system. Commanders still have non-judicial authority. They still have other lesser forms of judicial authority to deal with lesser crimes. But sex crimes and serious felonies, we shouldn't be giving that to commanding officers to determine the fate of. I mean, they've got too much on their plate. We're still at war, for God's sake. So, you know, I think it's a matter of prioritizing. Several of our common law allied nations have already moved to a less commander-focused legal system, and we need to follow suit. We're behind, just like with Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. We are also behind the curve when it comes to what our allied nations have already decided to do, because they already realized the bias in the system, that there was not a professional legal system within their own militaries. And we have to just acknowledge it's not a professional system within the U.S. military.
Okay. Let's bring Jessica Henvis into the conversation. She is an Air Force veteran, and she says she was raped by a fellow service member. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I do appreciate it.
Thank you. And Jessica, when did you join the Air Force and why? What was your thinking?
Well, I joined because I grew up around, my family was military, almost everybody in my family. My babysitter was former commander in the Air Force, and I had a very strong sense of what it meant to serve and the honor that it was to serve your country. And I was taught since I was a kid, everybody should serve. It's your duty as a citizen. It's a great opportunity to travel, and you meet the best people that you'll ever meet in your life. And I saw the sense of camaraderie amongst my family and the friends that we had adopted as family that were, you know, had maybe served or just maybe served with my family, or not even served, just served in the military. There's a real sense of family there, and I learned to respect that, and I expected that when I joined. And to an extent, I did find it, even though I was a F-15 mechanic and I was one of three females out of hundreds of men in my squadron. I did feel like their sister. I felt like part of the family unit until I reported my rape, and then I was ostracized like a leper from the whole community.
Jessica, before we get to that, were you concerned about the issue of sexual assault? What was that at all on your radar when you joined?
I had never heard of this issue in the military. Not in my entire life was it brought up. But when I did report, a member of my family told me that if I continue with this, I would probably lose my career. And I said, I don't think so. Legal's doing a good job. It's being investigated. And sure enough, it did end with me losing my career. While my rapist not only serves, but was awarded Airman of the Quarter Award during the middle of my investigation, and his commander recommended it didn't go to court. Against the advice of legal, even though he didn't have a legal education, any kind of background in legal, because of his rank, he was allowed to stop my case 2 days before court. And he said because my rapist didn't act like a gentleman, there wasn't a reason to prosecute, and it was left at that. There was nothing else to be done.
And do you feel like the investigation, the initial investigation, without going into any details, but do you feel it was comparable to the kind of investigation that is done in the civilian world? I've heard of certain bases or ships where there are not even rape kits.
Yeah, I had to go off base to get a rape kit. And then the military had lost some of the like the blood work that they had taken and different things that they did on base. They didn't have, I think there's only 18 people in the entire military that can actually do a forensics kit, and that's over, you know, hundreds of bases spread across the world. There's only 18 people. So that's an issue that, you know, that just shows that they're not equipped to deal with this. And it's not just, you know, the chain of command can't handle this. It's that the entire military system is not set up for the victim. As soon as you report, OSI is not, it depends on the individual, but it's not streamlined how they deal with the cases. So, you know, there's a lot of harm done right from there and all the way through mental health, through how you have to deal with your command and your peers.
Yeah, Jessica, can you describe for us, sorry to interrupt you, can you describe for us just how you felt? Here you are having gone through an incredibly terrible experience, and tell us what it was like to then try to report it and then finding all that.
I understood right away that there was going to be repercussions on me because the man who raped me, I never would have suspected it. He was a top performer. He was a very good crew chief, a good jet mechanic. He was very close with the higher-ups. He would hang out in their office. You know, when we went TDY or training deployments, he would be with the higher-ups. And even when I was around them, there was harassment from my higher-ups, too. Like, I had a senior officer talk to me about him and his wife were having problems, and he thought I was pretty, and it made inappropriate advancements that I don't want to go into. And I had another enlisted higher officer that told me, show me your tits in front of everybody, and I mean, it was constant with things like that. You know, people would show you their penis, they would show you pornography like a news said, and so I had gotten used to an atmosphere like that, and I realized when I report, nobody's going to have my back in this situation. You know, and absolutely nobody did. They kept telling me to drop it. It's sex. Why am I getting him in trouble? He's going to lose his career. And people got increasingly aggressive until I was moved to another state, to another base, to get away from that. Well, nobody received any punishment for any of that, but.
So even your friends, even the people you were friends with or thought you were friends with, didn't support you. Nobody had a kind word for you.
Actually, when they moved me to my new base, they had called and said to watch out for me. I was a problem child. I was, you know, somebody that they need to look out for and protect their airmen from. And I was treated as such. They said I was under investigation, but they didn't mention that it was for rape. They just thought I was somebody that had gotten in trouble. And I was treated like the entire time it was treated like, you know, are you sure this isn't just regret? Are you sure this is rape? And they would ask, what is the difference in rape and regret? And it was reiterated constantly.
Let me pose a quick question to Anu Bhagwati. I'm wondering now if this is what Jessica experienced on base. What are women in combat zones or men who have experienced sexual assault? I'm sure it's a very dangerous thing to report a case.
Well, it is. I mean, I don't want to get too wrapped up in the idea that things are always worse in combat, because the vast majority of assaults and harassment happen every day throughout the military, you know, in the barracks. I mean, it doesn't have to be a sort of extreme situation like a combat scenario. But certainly in a deployed scenario, there are fewer resources at your fingertips because you are so often, you know, in the middle of an extreme situation. And so, yeah, I mean, we get phone calls and emails from deployed women and men I mean, it is horrifying because also obviously the priority of the unit at that point is very much so operational, right? It's about defeating the enemy and bringing everybody presumably back home safe. And so when there's one or two so-called problem children, you know, raising allegations of rape. You hear this kind of language all the time. I hope you sense my sarcasm, but it's a horrifying situation when you're nowhere near home and you are considered the enemy as mm-hmm. well within your unit.
And Jessica, I want to follow up with you. You were eventually diagnosed with a personality disorder. How did that happen?
Oh, okay. I'll try to make this a quick story. I was actually discharged with PTSD from the rape. Even though I fought to keep my career, they said if I fought it anymore, I would get another diagnosis and not get any benefits. Then after I started doing activist work and I was in the Invisible War and part of a lawsuit against the Ferris Doctrine, I found, like, I had gotten a letter saying that if I wanted to come back to duty, I'd be reevaluated. That's when they tried to give me a personality disorder then to say it was a pre-existing condition so that I would lose all of my benefits. And I fought it and ended up getting a higher diagnosis for personage rape for PTSD. But I would like to say this issue is, it's just so apparent being in the system and seeing how each part of it fails. It's much like the Catholic Church, how they move the predators around or they move the victims around. And they were allowed to govern themselves until it was brought to the light, and they had to change. And the military is only going to change if we make them. And this has been throughout time, like Anu mentioned, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I was in the military when they were letting people serve openly, and everybody was thinking, this is going to be a huge deal. Well, they came in and they made it clear that you will not harass anybody that comes forward as a homosexual. And I didn't see... Within my entire squadron, within the entire wing, I didn't see anybody receive harassment once it passed because without any flaw, because it was made clear that we won't tolerate this. It's not going to happen. And that's what needs to happen with women. Although more men are being assaulted, it's the level of harassment to women that's allowing these predators to continue and for people to just keep brushing it off as if it's just sex. Women are allowed to be objectified in the military, which creates an unsafe environment. So the military can handle the harassment part of it. They cannot govern themselves with these rape cases. They need experts. They need independent people to come in and observe it. Because even if it makes it to court, the commander is selecting the judge, the jury, the prosecutioner. They're saying whether the conviction can stick or not, and they're also saying whether it can even go to court. So we have to keep on them, you know, because I believe in the future, we're going to look back and say, I can't believe women were talked to like that in the military. It's going to be like how they used to talk to the black soldiers. I can't believe how they treated the black soldiers. And I think this right now, what's happening, we're going to look forward and say, I can't believe women were talked to like that.
All right, Jessica, we have to take a short break. That's Jessica Henvis. She's an Air Force veteran. We're also joined by Anu Bagwadi of Service Women's Action Network. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 if you have a question on this topic of sexual assault in the military. You're listening to Radio Times. We'll be right back.
The Penn Museum in Philadelphia supports WHYY, Black Bodies and Propaganda, The Art of the War Poster, opens at the Penn Museum Sunday, June 2nd. Dr. Takufu Zuberi, Penn professor and host of PBS's History Detectives television series, has collected a set of historic posters aimed at mobilizing Africans and African Americans in war efforts, even as they faced oppression at home. Details on the new exhibition and opening day program online at penn.museum.
Jury selection in the federal racketeering trial of the legendary Boston criminal Whitey Bulger begins next week. Bulger was wanted for 19 murders when he was captured in 2011 after 16 years on the lam. Bulger was also an informant and got protection from the FBI. On the next Fresh Air, two journalists who've covered his story join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Is Iraq on the verge of civil war? Dozens of people have been killed in the deadliest violence in 5 years. Also, the discovery of genetically modified wheat in a field in Oregon is prompting fears about U.S. exports. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about sexual assault in the military with Anu Bhagwati. She's a veteran Marine captain and also director and co-founder of Service Women's Action Network. We're also talking with Jessica Henvis, who is an Air Force veteran and is sharing her personal story with this issue. And Jessica, you just told us before our break how you were given a diagnosis that was later removed. It was a personality disorder diagnosis. And Anu, that's something I've been reading a lot about, that victims who come forward then end up with some kind of diagnosis in their file.
That's right. It's unfortunately far too common. And we should remember that the personality disorder, it's not only an inaccurate diagnosis, but it's also a retaliatory diagnosis, because when you're diagnosed with personality disorder, it disqualifies you from military service. So you are forced to be discharged. It also bars you from getting VA benefits. And mind you, for rape and assault survivors who are being improperly diagnosed with something as awful as a personality disorder diagnosis, you're probably suffering from post-traumatic stress or depression, which are equally life-threatening in terms of the trauma and the effect on your day-to-day life. And so you need support. You need those VA benefits. And yet you're just booted out of the military, as if, like Jessica said, as if you're a leper.
And Jessica,
and so it takes years sometimes to undo those records, yeah, and to remove that mark from
Jessica,
from your
you
record.
Recently did that, right? You recently, or fairly recently, removed that mark.
Yes, ma'am. It took going to court, getting an independent lawyer, and which was very costly, and flying down to Lackland with my children. My husband was deployed at the time, and it was re-traumatizing, I feel like, because it would have made me lose all of my military benefits because of a false diagnosis.
But you succeeded.
Yes, ma'am. I ended up getting a higher percentage rate. I had to get a full psychological screening done, which found I had zero pre-existing conditions and that I had 100% for PTSD.
How did you go about, how did you pick up the pieces of your life after you were ejected out of the military?
It's been the hardest struggle of my life. The rape was one thing, but how the military handled it internally was completely betraying, and it really blew my mind of the best people I've met in my life really are in the military. There's really great people, but the way the system handles rape and just threw me out, I felt disposable, and it really destroyed my whole ideal of the military. This is some kind of rotten corrosion in our military that I can't allow. And I devote a lot of my personal time to change this, because it's really a national security issue. We can't allow this to go on in other countries. We can't allow this to go on in our own military. We can't take their polished, friendly-sounding excuses or ideas that they can handle this internally. Like Anu said, for decades, this has been going on. I know Vietnam veterans that have it has destroyed their life for 30 years because they haven't had the recognition that we have now, that it's out in public. And we have to keep this pressure on them. The media can do that.
And Jessica, do you know where the man is who you say is your perpetrator, is the perpetrator in this case? Where is he?
Oh, he's stationed at Beale Air Force Base now.
And let me ask you this, and Anu, maybe you can weigh in on this. We had a caller earlier who had to move on, but his question was, is there any way you could take matters in your own hands? Not suggesting vigilante justice, but he is wondering, you know, is there any recourse that you have once you become a civilian, and maybe once that person becomes a civilian? Anu?
I mean, one of the really interesting things, I mean, it's a horrible thing to realize, is military service members don't have access to civil suits. Mm-hmm. In the civilian system, If you're a victim of a sex crime or workplace harassment, just generally discrimination, let's say as a woman in the workforce, you have access to the criminal justice system, which oftentimes fails you. But at the end of the day, you also have access to civil suits where you can take your employer to court, sue for damages, right? And that acts as a huge deterrent to employers. And it often acts as an incentive, and sometimes judges require that they change their employment practices to make it safer for employees, and especially women. And military members have no access to those civil suits. So again, fewer constitutional rights are available, fewer forms of legal redress. So how is the military supposed to change? And how are service members supposed to expect an iota of justice when they can't even, if the military justice system fails them, they have no outside redress. They have no additional form of justice available to them.
So once your case is closed, it's done. It's done. Jessica, did you just have to kind of mentally close this chapter and say, I will never get justice? In this case, I'll have to do something else?
Yes. I wasn't allowed to take it to civilian court because it was a military jurisdiction. I tried the base inspector general, but they said they were too busy to handle this case. So there was nothing I could do. And I wasn't given the time from my job to recover from this and to process it. I was expected to suck it up and move on. Everybody treated this like it's just sex, you know. And the military doesn't understand the level that rape brings into your life, the level of, it's a lifelong scar. The problem that I think the STOP Act addresses, and I really appreciate Congresswoman Speer for, you know, leading the charge in this with the STOP Act, is it has a special victim unit. So when you're raped, you go into the unit, you're given a group of professional trained investigators that are trained in dealing with rape. There's counseling, there's peer support, because it's statistically proven that if you deal with trauma right after it happens, like the military does with combat trauma, it doesn't have to be PTSD. You can continue your career. They're allowing combat veterans to continue with PTSD. I was put in a group with them because there's nothing for rape survivors. But I wasn't allowed to continue my career because I have PTSD from rape. There's no other distinction there.
And Jessica, how are you now? How many years out are we at this point?
I got out in April of 2011, and I was given an honorable retirement this September. So I'm trying to move on. It's easier to do the advocacy work, and there's Facebook groups of other MST survivors that offer me a lot of support. But when I have to face this problem, I just about crumble. I can't function in my life. It's
what happens to you? What happens? Can you describe?
Yeah, I have two children under two, and it's there's a lot of weight that my husband picks up. When I try to go to the VA for counseling, the last few appointments have either been canceled or they haven't checked me in, and you know, it's been a nightmare. But I come home from usually the VA, and after trying to face it, and I just go to bed, or I have chronic migraines. I have a hard time getting outside. A lot of anxiety, depression. These are things I never dealt with. I'm a pretty outgoing person normally, but this has made me a completely different person than who I am. I'm having to relearn who I even am now.
And I just to throw a number out there, in 2010, the VA conducted nearly 700,000 outpatient counseling sessions for vets who had experienced military sexual trauma. So Anu, that gives us some idea of the fallout from this issue that's ongoing.
Yeah, it's enormous, and almost half of those patients are men. We should remember that.
I did want to ask about male victims, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as we said earlier, over half of the victims currently within the military are male. And so rape and assault and harassment have always happened in the military, even prior to women joining in larger numbers.
And Anu,
majority have been male.
Would you say that there is even more shame and reluctance to report when the victim is male?
I mean, I can't speak on behalf of any men, but Yes. I mean, anecdotally, we hear time and time again. I mean, it's not surprising when you consider our society and how homophobic it is, even on the outside, that homophobia and misogyny oftentimes becomes worse within the military, where men are, you know, real men are supposed to mm-hmm. be a certain way, and women and anything that's considered outside is not welcome. And so, you know, all of these kind of rites of passage that many men and our young men in particular have to face. I mean, there's assault and hazing rituals within all male units happen routinely, but they may not be perceived as assault in the case of women. So.
And let me ask both of you a bit about the culture of the military culture, because there are certain things. You're supposed to accept hardships and suffering. You're supposed to be tough. You have to value the group over yourself. You have to follow a chain of command. Does that make it a perfect environment for assault? Just because there are so many things that are hammered into you every day, that it's not about you, it's about the group, and you're not important.
Well, I would say, I mean, serial predators thrive in the military. They are, I mean, just the way Jessica was describing, you know, her perpetrator, most perpetrators are stand-up, stellar service members. They wouldn't look the way one would stereotypically think of a predator. I mean, they are extremely strategic in the way that they stalk their victims, break them down, harass them, and assault them. I mean, they have an MO that is very well known by investigators today, and they are serial predators. In other words, they don't just commit these acts against one victim, but against dozens. And so they know they can thrive within the military because very few predators are ever held accountable. Very few commanding officers are punished for failing to hold them accountable. It's a great system. It's a target-rich environment for perpetrators.
But Jessica, as you said, if it was made clear that this will absolutely not be tolerated, you feel that it would not happen?
I feel like the military can handle the harassment. And there's a difference in the harassment and the rape. Because if they say this is not acceptable, then that's going to protect the men so they can come forward too. Because when a man comes forward now, they're either called gay or they're made fun of for, you know, having sex with a man. It's not considered rape yet in the military. Even General Welsh was saying it's a hookup culture. Well, how does that feel to a female that's raped? But even more importantly, how does that feel to a man that's been raped? The military they don't get it. They're not able to because they're not trained in this. They're trained in warfare. They're trained in, you know, order and good order and conduct. And this blows that out of the water. It's almost too much for them to process. We need an expert team that knows how to deal with this to come in and, you know, scrape out all the old festering things, the ideals that happen. And the military can support that by tackling harassment, which is a huge issue. That's a cultural shift in the issue in the military right now. It's not women in warfare. This is harassment. Men and women are being harassed.
And in the few minutes that we have left, Jessica, what's your advice for young people in the military right now or for those who are considering going in? I know this is really an issue that's on the radar. I recently had a friend whose daughter was going into the Navy. She was very concerned about this. So what's your advice for people who are new to this world or going in?
Really, I mean, I would say to go to college and get an education and wait until this is fixed. Give it a few years. I mean, I would love to tell people to join, but I couldn't tell my children to join and, you know, until this is fixed. So conscionably, I can't say you should join because statistically it's 1 in 3 women, 1 in 8 men. I mean, that's playing Russian roulette, and they're not going to support you. When you look at the 1 in 8 men, there's actually more, 75% more men. So there's more men actually being raped right now. So it's, you know, not just young women. People need to really look at, you know, at this. And if they really want to join, support the Stop Act, support Senator Gillibrand, you know, write Congress and Senate and say, you know, pass these because I want to join, but not under this climate.
Anu, what's your take?
Well, I
I strongly encourage anyone who wants to join to join, to follow their dreams. My concern is with fixing the system. It's the nation's responsibility to make the military a safe environment for its sons and daughters. It's not any single woman or man's responsibility. I mean, it's really on us to do the work here. And I you know, if I ever have children, I would love for them to join the military. But you know, this is on our government right now to fix, and we're working every day to make sure it's a safer climate.
And Anu, you've taken on this new battle. Are you sad that your career in the military, you couldn't pursue that because of this issue? Are you feeling content now fighting this fight?
I mean, I'm a full-time advocate. I was probably a full-time advocate when I was in uniform as well, frankly. But you know, we're making huge changes right now. I mean, the fact that we're engaged in conversations like this today is evidence of that. You know, I would like to also just add as a final word that there's an enormous issue with veterans' benefits when it comes to this problem. It's not just VA healthcare that. One of the real injustices lies in lack of access for sexual trauma survivors who are trying to access benefits. And we actually found out that only 1 in 3 assault or harassment survivors who file for PTSD-related benefits get those benefits from VA. And VA is running a fierce PR campaign to deny that, but it is an excruciating process for any veteran filing a claim for a service-connected wound or injury, but for sexual trauma survivors, that hill is even steeper.
And with that, we're going to have to close. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us today. Anu Bagwadi is a veteran Marine captain. She is executive director and co-founder of Service Women's Action Network. We also heard from Jessica Henvis. Thank you, Jessica, so much for sharing your personal story. She is an Air Force veteran and now a board member for Protect Our Defenders. Thank you so much for listening to Radio Times. I'm Maiken Scott in for Marty Moskowain.